You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Right off the bat, there's Lyle Thompson.
Kylie O'Miller showing off those shifty skills.
Driver driving hard down the alley and he scores.
What a goal from Josh Bird.
Caleb Trainer
flips and scores.
You're kidding me.
By Dylan Ward.
Gets topside. Rambo scores.
Welcome to Pro Lacrosse Talk, your go-to podcast for interviews with professional players, coaches, and executives, as well as the latest news and analysis from all three professional lacrosse leagues. Now, here's your host, Hutton Jackson.
All right, what's up, Pro Lacrosse fans? Welcome to another edition of Pro Lacrosse Talk presented by Fanatics. Reminder, if you're especially a Mammoth fan, and you haven't gotten your Colorado Mammoth Championship gear, you guys can get that on the official NLL shop. If you go to prolacrossetalk.com/NLL shop, you guys can give us a slight kickback if you buy anything using that link, so be sure to use that. But I'm your host, Sutton Jackson. Today I'm joined by PLT contributors Brian Andrews and Topher Adams. Appreciate you guys hopping on. We had a week off last week. A lot to talk about this week, though. We're going to preview the PLL All-Star Game. We're going to talk a little NLL expansion draft recap after we previewed it last week. Then we're going to talk a little bit of PLL Week 5, even though, you know, we're 2 weeks from that. We had a little off week this past weekend, but we'll get some All-Star Game stuff discussed, and then we're back at PLL Week 6 coming up soon as well. But to start, we're not going to talk about either the NLL or the PLL. We're going to talk about a new professional lacrosse league, one that kind of came out of nowhere and really doesn't have much semblance of anything to start just yet, but it's the Professional Box Lacrosse Association. They announced they're targeting a December start date, and it looks to be competing directly with the NLL as another professional box lacrosse association. Not sure how it's going to really fare. You know, unlike the PLL-MLL situation, where the MLL obviously had a lot of issues and there was rumblings kind of leading up to it. You also had Paul Rabel, you know, arguably the biggest name in the sport at the time, with a bunch of the top players going over to the PLL. This is a little bit more interesting. The league doesn't have any big names tied to it. No teams. They're going to announce locations soon and then apparently let fans pick the names of the teams when the cities were revealed. So very, very interesting model. We're definitely going to keep monitoring this. I will say one thing that is interesting is the NLL is currently, in the laps of a CBA. They need a new CBA. They opted out of their final year of their deal this past negotiation period. So they do need a new collective bargaining agreement between the NLL and the NLLPA, and the NLL is still yet to announce a new commissioner. So I don't think the NLL is going anywhere. It's just finished up its 35th year, guys. I wouldn't be too worried about the NLL. I'm sure things will get going pretty soon. We have free agency coming up August 1st. But it is an interesting time. You know, if there was a good time to launch a competing league against the NLL, it's probably no time, but the second best would probably be right now. So not sure how this is going to fare, but we'll continue to monitor it. I'll just go with each of you, your thoughts on the Professional Box Lacrosse Association. Just from what you've seen so far, and do you think, you know, it will make any waves in the professional box lacrosse scene? I'll start with you, Brian.
Yeah, I feel like I could outline my feelings as mostly just kind of confused. I feel like it kind of came out of nowhere. The start date is like very soon. I don't even think they have the last time I checked, they didn't even have a Twitter account for this league yet. The marketing materials look very scrapped together. It's very unclear. They say they're going to announce cities, but I'm skeptical about where they're going to play, like where they're even going to play. Where are they exactly sourcing players from? There are some confusing press releases about bringing that quote saying, bringing American players back to make this a really competitive league. Very unclear what that means. I think that was in Business Wire. Maybe we'll put it in like the show notes. I'll send Hutton you the link to that. But very confusing all around. I'm excited, but like you said, Hutton, mostly I'm confused because there's not really a huge need for this, especially since we already see players kind of not like internally, well, yeah, maybe internally conflicted about playing for the PLL versus the MSL. Like, it feels like there's already so many leagues floating around, and with so many of the bigger leagues getting production broadcast deals, even the MSL has announced a smaller broadcast deal. It feels like the amount of market share that a new league can capture is very small currently. So it's a lot of unanswered questions, and their timeline is really short. So I really don't know what to think. And I'm kind of excited to see how it goes, because alternate or competing big professional sports leagues have been very popular recently, and very few of them have gone that well. So I'm very excited to see where this ends up going.
You know, absolutely. It's interesting, too, that it's actually going to be ran by former NLL commissioner John Livesey Jr. and then former Rochester Nighthawks owner Steve Donner. So it is some former NLL people kind of breaking away. But I agree with you, Brian. And, you know, the thing with the PLL-MLL is, you know, we saw pretty much a good competition between both of them, given the fact that it's a pretty healthy split player-wise. The PLL probably had a little bit better players when they split. Completely different business models in terms of, you know, MLL was not single entity at the time of the split and went to single entity kind of following suit. Obviously, PLL has always been single entity. PLL is touring-based, MLL is city-based, so a lot of differences. This one's kind of setting it up to be like just another NLL, but NLL light. And, you know, I will be curious to see what cities they go to. But with the focus on the United States, I don't think it's a bad idea. But we've seen how popular the game is in Canada. You know, like the Canadian markets, all of them have been very, very successful. In terms of the United States, you look at the NLL, there's still some markets that are really struggling. And I think they're starting to get their footing, but the focus specifically on the U.S. market, I don't know if it's the timing's right for that right now. And then, like you said, it was kind of a head-scratcher the way they were talking about players. But, yeah, definitely certainly looking forward to seeing, you know, what comes of it. I know, Topher, kind of what are your thoughts when you heard that this new league was getting started?
Yeah, I mean, a lot like Brian, you said, it's just kind of confusing. I don't really see a point, honestly, of trying to start another professional box league. We have the NLL, and it seems to be improving its professionalism. You know, you mentioned it has the ESPN Plus and TSN streaming package now. You know, there seems to be more money invested in it, especially with the wave of expansion over the past few seasons. So this isn't like the MLL was when the PLL split, where it was still very kind of strung together, not as well-funded or professional. The NLL is on an upward trajectory on all those fronts, so it doesn't seem like there's like a weakness, like a huge weakness to try and attack. And, you know, as Brian mentioned, it's not like what we're seeing from this new league's marketing materials or anything like that is extremely, it's not wowing anybody with its, you know, presentation or its professionalism. So I'm very skeptical, but, you know, if this means more guys get to play lacrosse more often and we get to see more professional lacrosse games somewhere on the internet or on TV, then I'm fine with that.
Yeah, no, that's the right attitude to have. You know, like, it's never a bad thing to have more lacrosse. But, yeah, like you, I'm a little, you know, skeptical just because there's no really huge names attached to it. Obviously, we mentioned the two guys that are former NLL guys, but it's not like, you know, we just saw a Las Vegas team add Wayne Gretzky as an owner for the NLL. You know, that's some really positive backing. And you look at even the PLL, Joe Tsai, not only investing in, you know, two NLL teams, but the PLL as well. That was a big name associated with it. So haven't really seen that. Maybe we will be surprised. Maybe there is some big names kind of working behind the scenes to get this off the ground. But currently that's all we really know about it and all we can really talk about it. But definitely curious to see what comes of it for sure. But in terms of the established professional box lacrosse league, the NLL, we had a great expansion draft, guys. A lot of twists and turns. A lot of them that we kind of saw coming, you know, a little bit of a way, you know, in terms of kind of fields getting drafted and traded. We had talked Brett McIntyre potentially getting drafted and traded back to the Mammoth, which happened, you know, but it was very still hard to predict. And a lot of these moves set up Vegas, not only, you know, for their inaugural season, but I think for the future. A lot of young guys were taken, surprisingly, not really any big stars. But then again, you know, when an expansion draft happens, a lot of those big stars are off the table because they're protected. So not too big of a shocker, but I really liked a lot of the Las Vegas moves. I thought the Connor Fields trade was a great win-win for both Rochester and Vegas. So, you know, Connor Fields was drafted. He was the band's player drafted, and they ended up flipping him right away to Rochester for a handful of future picks. And in return, they get Charlie Bertrand back. And then Riley Hutchcraft, who they also drafted from Toronto, is going to Rochester as well. So very, very interesting to see that those guys get drafted and then flipped right away. And to see Rochester be the team, he stays in the upstate New York area, but as a member of the Rochester Nighthawks. And I think that's a big gift for him, for them, and big for him too, to stay up in upstate New York. But they added another star to this young team that showed some bright spots. And I think they're a team that's going to really surprise some people next year. You know, they played obviously in the tough East, but it'll be interesting to see how they take that next step next year for sure. But in terms of the people that were added to this expansion team, we'll go down the list just to give you guys an idea if you weren't able to see initially. But Jackson Nishimura was taken. Connor Fields was obviously taken by the Bandits, but he was flipped to get Charlie Bertrand. They also took Riley Hutchcraft from the Toronto Rock. He was also flipped to Rochester. Landon Kells, only goalie that was drafted and kept. Two other goalies were taken. We mentioned Hutchcraft and also Frank Chiliano. But Frank Chiliano was flipped back to the Seals for some picks. And those picks were Mark Lucini and Brendan Cleland. So they get two pieces for Chiliano, who we expected to, you know, return to the Seals, whether it was via, you know, draft and trade like this or just, you know, returning, getting passed on. But they decided to draft him and then flip him for some assets. Brett McIntyre got picked. But they would trade him back in return to get Sam Firth, as well as Eric Turner. Connor Kearse was the guy taken from the Swarm. A lot of different options they had with the Swarm. Kearse ends up being the guy. Obviously played really, really well in season one and been playing well for the Whipsnakes as well in the field game. James Barclay surprisingly goes for the Halifax Thunderbirds. Ty Thompson was drafted from the Riptide. Jack Hanna, who hasn't even suited up for Panther City yet, was taken. Jackson Subak from the Wings. John Wagner from Rochester, Tyson Rowe from Vancouver, and then finally Jeff Cornwall from Saskatchewan Rush. I thought that was a big pickup for them if they would kept him. They actually flip him, though, to Calgary in return to get Marshall King. So I think Marshall King's a good piece for them to build. Interesting enough that Calgary was able to do that. Definitely, you know, see that they were probably looking to shore up some side on the defensive side a little bit, and saw that Cornwall would be a good move, and probably had that deal in place, you know, leading up to the expansion draft. But that was one that I thought is going to be very interesting to see how it plays out next season. But that was your expansion draft. I'll go with you, Brian. Thoughts on this expansion draft and some of the guys that were taken, any of that stand out to you?
Yeah, I feel very similar overall to how you explained how you felt, where they did a really good job at maximizing the return from the draft. After looking at the results, I actually went back and looked at Panther City's expansion draft from last year and the results just to see how much they moved, because I didn't remember that draft necessarily being as exciting or complex, and it really wasn't. They did make a move against the Mammoth where they traded back one of their players they left unprotected for two guys. So that happened to the Mammoth twice in a row in two consecutive expansion drafts. But they did a really good job at also picking up future capital without sacrificing a lot of future capital. And I really like your point about mainly focusing on youth, because I think that kind of was a perspective that I wasn't really thinking about going into the draft for like uniformly drafting youth. And for that reason, a lot of picks were really surprising to me, like no Dawson Thiebe from Halifax, Subak, as opposed to Krepinsek or Isaiah Davis Allen from the Wings. Kearse over Walker from the Swarm, Ty Thompson from Riptide instead of McCardle or Dan Lomas. Landon Kells is one of the younger goalies that was available. So I think their strategy in retrospect was really clear. They're focused on a young core of capable guys. Very excited to see Jack Hanna suit up, by the way. Young, capable guys, and I think they're going to try to build on top of that from draft, from the entry draft, and kind of go for a long-term plan instead of, hey, let's make waves in the first season potentially, even though they might still do that too.
Yeah, no, for sure. And like you said, I'm really excited to see Jack Hanna. You know, some American talent, young American talent we saw, you know, with Kearse and Bertrand, both having great rookie seasons. You know, that stuff I feel like you wouldn't have saw maybe a couple of years ago in expansion drafts, where you know, some of these young American talents that don't have that much box experience end up getting drafted. Now, Jack Hanna has actually had box experience playing in the Collegiate Box Association or Box League for a couple of years. So it's not like he's completely green like Connor Kearse was, but Kearse and Bertrand were both, you know, new to the box game and have really excelled, you know, both field and box. So nice to see them, you know, get at it as pieces. But like you said, yeah, I think it's the way to do it. Obviously, we saw it work really well with Panther City. They had maybe a few more veterans than this group, but, you know, we got free agency coming up August 1st. So no stopping Sean Williams from going out and getting some big names in free agency. I feel like we're going to see one or two as well. So we'll definitely be monitoring that. I know you kind of saw youth as a big movement as well, Topher. Final thoughts kind of on the NLL expansion draft from your perspective.
Yeah, just to wrap it up, same thing you guys have been saying. This definitely was not an expansion draft necessarily designed to win this first season and make a title chase this season, at least not in this phase of roster building. They targeted guys who are going to probably be a part of this group for the next, you know, 5-6 years. That's probably their intention with some of these dudes, you know, like Jack Hanna, like Bertrand. You know, these are guys that aren't here just to try and win in the next 3 seasons. These are long-term pieces to kind of set up a foundation for the Vegas franchise so that they have something to build upon in this next era of the National Lacrosse League.
No, absolutely. And we're certainly looking forward to see them take the floor, you know, this winter, you know, as long as everything goes according to plan. And free agency is right around the corner, guys. So that's definitely going to be something. We saw a crazy free agency last year, you know, especially given the fact that there was a 1 year hiatus, essentially. But I'm sure we're going to see some other shakeups come this offseason as well.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for the Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Now let's move on to PLL Week 5. You know, we're a week removed, but we're going to recap that a little bit because we had a lot of happen. We had one of, I think, the best games of the year in the Chrome versus Atlas, and that was essentially for top spot in the league. Atlas ended up prevailing, but we'll start off with Archers Redwoods, the first game of PLL Week 5. A close one. You know, I think we kind of all expected it to be a little bit close. We thought the Redwoods would have a chance just given the fact that they would have an advantage at the stripe, but this one really came down to the wire. I'll start off with you, Brian. Thoughts on the Archers Redwoods? Archers get the win, but only by a goal. Again, faceoffs continue to be one of their Achilles heels, despite, you know, being one of the most efficient offenses. But thoughts on this game?
Happy to see Kelly get the nod and perform well. I mean, we were talking about it leading up to that game that we'd all thought collectively that Kelly deserved the start for a week to see what he could do, even though his first start in week one, the second half of week one, didn't go exactly as he probably hoped it did. So good to see him bounce back. They were at a make or break point at that position for this season. The change had to be made because they needed some momentum somewhere. And I think that being the first game really that I can think of where they had over 50% save percentage really shows how much goalie play really affects it and makes the defense look better. For the first 3 weeks or so, we were talking about how the Redwoods defense doesn't really look up to, you know, up to snuff. But really, when your goalie's only saving 30% of the shots, it's really hard to say that your defense is playing well regardless of how well they actually are playing, because on paper it looks really, really bad. So holding a team like the Archers, who look great even without Amend still, you know, to 10 goals is definitely impressive, and it does show the importance of having a good goalie. I mean, the Chaos are also an argument for that. But if they continue to hold teams to 11, 12 goals like they have been, even with Trautner's, you know, subpar performance, their offense is really only scoring 9 goals a game. And if you don't account for the 3-goal game against the Chrome, they're goals average is still 10.5, which is just not high enough to win in this league. And when you look at their offensive personnel and their production, they only have three guys with 10 or more points. And the third highest scorer on the team is Miles Jones, whose production has drastically decreased from last year to this year when he was, one of the runners up for MVP, or at least everyone was very vocal about him being in the conversation. And so that's a place where they really need to figure it out, where they need some depth to step up to help contribute more to the success of the team. Because if they can't consistently score above 10 goals, there's no way to succeed in this league.
And what are your thoughts, Topher, on Archers, Redwoods, either team, and how they turned out in week 5?
Yeah, just, one more thing on the Redwoods side of that. I think they've looked more like the Redwoods over the past couple of games. The defense is active and forcing turnovers. You mentioned Jack Kelly finally provided functional goalie play, let alone good goalie play, just someone who is a functional shot stopper right now. But what they're missing is that third star, just another guy who can do something on offense. And that's definitely where one of the Notre Dame attackmen has to do something. Matt Kavanaugh has had a really, really tough start to the season, first half of the season. He's been pretty invisible most of the year. He's one of the top players on the team. He has to deliver. And if it's not him, that's got to be Ryder Garnsey doing something, either replacing Kavanaugh in the starting lineup or doing something for midfield or playing, as the third attackman, whatever. One of those guys has to start performing up to their talent level, and then the Redwoods will score enough and have enough offensive cohesion and effectiveness to take advantage of their improved defensive play. And then on the Archers side, you mentioned this offense is still able to produce at a really high level in spite of Grant Amet's injury for the entire first half of the season. He's the anchor of their attack line and kind of the catalyst of their offense opposite Tom Schreiber. But, they've looked fine. They've looked perfectly fine. If you told me they were missing the best attackman in the league, I wouldn't believe you, because they're just still so fluid. And Connor DeSimone, who's played in that role, deserves a lot of credit, not for replicating his production, but for finding his role within the team just as a tertiary option to allow the guys who are the big playmakers, like Schreiber, like Matt Moore now, and then both Holman and Manny, to just do what they do best. And, one more thing on this offense. Last week was Marcus Holman's best game of the season by a lot. He was big on social media because of the celebration that kind of went pseudo-viral on Lacrosse Twitter. But, he was more effective than he had been all season. And he's had actually a pretty decent season. But him on the right was a terror. You still have Manny, who had one of his quietest games, and he still had 3 points. So when they're humming like they have been, they're effective. And, this game could have been worse if Jack Kelly had only been down at 30%. This is still a very good offense, and it continues to be the most, I'd say probably the most fun unit to watch offensively consistently, just because the way they move the ball with and without their best players is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I love this Archers team. If the faceoffs weren't such a big Achilles heel, I think they're the top team in the league right now. And I actually have, faith in Justin Inacio to, maybe actually put it together. He was put in a tough position. Any young faceoff guy coming into this league as a rookie, it's always going to be at a disadvantage because the rules are so different. They move in the wings. These long poles are right on top of you. The wing players are right on top of you. And he's seemed to improve each week, even going 7-for-18. He went against T.D. Irwin, who obviously hasn't had the best season so far. But I think, this team has proven that, they're just a good face-off game away from Inacio from really beating up on teams. And we even saw that they beat up on the Cannons despite losing the face-off battle. So I'm still really high on this Archers team, and I'm glad you brought up Marcus Holman, because he's still performing at a high level. And he kind of struggled, a little bit last year and in 2020 as well. And he's kind of looking like his old self, and we don't know how many more years he has just because of the offensive weapons on the Archers. But he's proven that he still deserves to be a top spot in that lineup every week. 6 points in this game, 4 goals. One was a 2-pointer that right at half that was just an absolute rocket. And like you mentioned, Will Manny and him just continue to just be two of the best shooters in the league. I really think it's those two and Ryan Brown is the top shooters in the PLL. And they continue to do it week in and week out. And Marcus Holman does it in a variety of different ways. You know, Will Manny can score in a variety of different ways too, but we know he's a little bit closer to that lefty 10 yards out type of shooter, where Marcus Holman's doing it right side, left side, middle of the field, you know, kind of all over. But I did see some positives from the Redwoods. I think Charlie Bertrand's been looking a lot, looking like a real key piece to this offense. And, you know, you look at Rob Pinnell had 4 assists. He made the defenses respect him a little bit more this game. And I think that's big for kind of unlocking this offense. But, yeah, like you said, still too quiet from Kavanaugh, as well as Sergio Perkovic, 0-for-7 shooting. I mean, he's got to get involved more. To see him just kind of really, really not perform at all so far. He only has 1 goal. He has a 2-point goal and a 1-point goal, so he only has 3 points off of, you know, those two goals, essentially, because one was a 2-pointer. That's not enough. You know, they need to get him involved more, and he needs to shoot better. So definitely some woes that they got to work out, but it is positive seeing Jack Kelly. I'm glad we saw him start. I think he needs to be the starter going forward until you see anything change. Trautner could still be the guy of the future, but I think it's a kind of a whipsnake situation of last year where, you know, you've given Trautner enough of a leash now. Time to go ride with Kelly, kind of like they did with Phipps. So certainly I think that's the way to go. But we'll move on to Chrome Atlas, and I'll go with you, Topher. Thoughts on this game with the Atlas and the Chrome, and what was a real barn burner late in the game?
Yeah, this was a real heavyweight matchup even before the game. Like, I think these were the top 2 teams probably in the league heading into the game. And it all started at the faceoff stripe with a big highlighted headliner matchup that the league is still pushing as the headliner matchup, as the two all-star captains with Baptiste and Farrell. And, you know, focusing just on that matchup, I think we can definitively say, with not a single person questioning it, Trevor Baptiste is the best faceoff guy in the world by several, like a whole order of magnitude difference. Because while he was healthy before he got the lower body injury at the end of the game, I think he was like 70-80% against Farrell, who was coming into the game easily second best percentage wise in the league. So he's just such a monster. And if he's healthy the back half of the season, he's probably the MVP of the league. But really, that whole game was, I don't know, it was just a really fun lacrosse game. The Chrome are a really fun team this year. They have a lot of grit. I think they're probably the grittiest team in the league, which isn't surprising given it's a Tim Sudan team and they still have that Rochester Rattlers energy, even as a lot of those guys have moved on from pro lacrosse. And, you know, they fought hard, and the Atlas are just probably the best team in the league right now, and they showed it by holding on for that victory.
Yeah, this was a phenomenal game. And, you know, you never, just knowing what the Chrome were able to do through 4 weeks, never felt like they were out of it, even when they were down 11-6 at halftime. You know, I kind of, you know, just felt like, I'm like, this Chrome team is going to come out strong. Sure enough, they make it a game, and it was back and forth throughout that third and fourth quarter after they went on that run to kind of tie it up. And then, you know, this Atlas team, though, this offense finally got going again, which was nice to see against a capable defense like the Chrome, because we saw them go up against 2 pretty weaker defenses in week 1 and 2, light them up, and then week 3 and 4 struggle. So they looked much better this week. You know, I still think the Chrome defense is in great shape, despite, you know, letting up those many goals against this Atlas team. You know, it's tough to do when you're playing Chris Gray, Jeff T, and Eric Law, 3 of the best, you know, attackmen in the league right now. So certainly thought they did a good job kind of keeping them in check as much as you could. But nice to see the Atlas offense again kind of get going, and Jeff T deliver another good game. I thought he played well in week 4 as well. Really, week 3 was the only game that really left a lot to be desired. But what about your Atlas, Brian? What do you think about this game?
Totally agree with Topher about everything he said about the faceoff, and I'll round back to the faceoff at the end of my little weekly diatribe about the Atlas. You mentioned the fact that the offense felt really alive again. And I agree with you, and I think a lot of it had to do with the different style of the Chrome defense relative to that of the Archers defense, where I brought up after they played the Archers and we were going into the Chrome matchup, that the Archers were just firing immediately as they were sliding immediately to disrupt the initiator of the dodge. And the Atlas midfield particularly were not handling that very well. They were retreating from the slide as opposed to redodging or finding an open man or moving the ball or something. It really slowed the offense down. They had like 10 goals that game. Chrome has been a slower to go team. And because of that, I think that allowed the Atlas to be more comfortable dodging, know that they were going to have space, be able to keep their head up, and the Chrome weren't doing as much to disrupt that flow of the Atlas offense. And I think that's a really different, important comparison. And I think going forward, if teams play more of a Chrome style against the Atlas, I think they're going to struggle and they're going to allow the Atlas midfield to contribute a little bit more. And we saw a little bit more midfield contribution from the Atlas. Costabile got a little bit involved. Caraway had a goal. But the midfield still needs to get more involved. Crawley and Aiken were both notably pointless. So their production is really driven from their attack. But if teams can really wipe out the contributions from the midfield for the Atlas, the offense really stalls. And we saw that again in the second half. And I think a lot of that had to do with the second half against the Chrome. I think a lot of that had to do with the lack of possessions. So when they got it to the other end of the field, I think the Atlas were just a little tired because they were playing a lot of defense. But we saw when you limit their possessions and you force the Atlas to slow down, that's what functionally allowed the Chrome to catch back up to them. So I think teams' keys to success against my Atlas, this is free coaching advice, I guess, is really disrupt their dodge, their initiators, through early slides rather than slow to go. And by doing so, you can generate more cost turnovers, which you need if you're losing at the faceoff stripe. If Baptiste, who, if he continues on this campaign, I think he's the MVP. Because once the Archers midfield gets involved, their offense is too diverse to stop. And if they're not, and if the Atlas can keep the ball because of Trevor Baptiste and their defense keeps playing at the level that they're playing at, I don't see a team that will really beat them in a deep playoff run, except maybe the Whipsnakes.
Yeah, no, I think they're still, in my mind, one of the top teams. I will say, though, you know, with Baptiste injuring his hamstring, you know, luckily he'll have 3 weeks. I'd be shocked if he plays in the All-Star game, although he is a captain, but he'll have 3 weeks to rest that up, and hopefully he'll be good to go. But let's say he's not 100%. Does that kind of diminish your guys' thoughts on the Atlas at all, or do you think they're still in good shape, you know, kind of like the Archers in a way, where Archers obviously have a disadvantage at faceoff, but we still consider them one of the top teams. Does that kind of change your opinion? Because we have said that Trevor Baptiste has essentially been the MVP. I think we're all kind of in agreement of that so far this season. There's a few other candidates up there as well, but he's been the most valuable player. If he can't go, you know, for a game or two, what are your thoughts on the Atlas then? I'll go back to you, Brian.
I think it complicates it a little bit. I think the most complicated part of it is the Atlas aren't really a team that have a pole, for example, that they could send up with a lot of experience at the stripe to kind of try to shut down, like Farrell, for example, and stop teams from getting transition off of the faceoff, which I think would be paramount for them being able to stay in games. Because once the faceoff equalized in the Chrome's direction, which was one of their like keys to success, if Farrell could equalize at the stripe, the Chrome could stay in the game essentially. And that's what we saw happen. Once he equalized, they caught back up. If Baptiste is out of the lineup and they aren't having success at the stripe, I don't think they have like a disruptor guy, like a Messenger or a CJ Costabile, to go out there and really shut down or really limit the effectiveness of a Farrell or a Nardella. Or if Erlen really, you know, gets hot in the second half of the season, those teams are going to be really tough for the Atlas to keep up with from an offensive pace.
No, I agree. You know, I definitely would be, you know, have some concern. Although I do think this offense can still perform. You lose some of those possession advantages, you know, that they had. That's essentially why they beat the Archers. Might be a different story if the Archers would have won a few more faceoffs. Thoughts for you, Topher, you know, if Baptiste isn't completely healthy when they come back after the All-Star break, do you still feel very strongly about this Atlas team? Or does it kind of make another team kind of more a favorite in your eyes?
Yeah, kind of to use the Archers comparison, for example, you know, they don't have a good, super effective face-off strategy, and they don't typically win close to 50% more often than not, but they very rarely give up that quick transition that Brian was talking about. And that's because they have the pulls to kind of muck it up either from the wing or at the stripe. And that's where Graham Hossick and Jared Connors and Scott Ratliff are so valuable for them in between the lines, is that face-off, how they can just muck it up and prevent any real transition opportunities. So that's what the fear is with Atlas, because they don't have that guy. They have Fop, I believe, right, from Syracuse as their backup. Yeah, so maybe he's good. We don't know. We haven't seen him play in the PLL yet. He was pretty decent in the ACC this past season. So maybe they could still, you know, fare pretty well the way Zach Tucci has for the Water Dogs without Jake Withers. So if he's like that 45-40% range, and he's just not, as long as he's not getting smoked, I think they'd be fine. But I do worry a little bit that they can give up that easy transition, those quick two for ones that you get without a Graham Hossack at the stripe, just kind of limiting any chance of transition.
Yeah, no, for sure. And, you know, I will say CVR, Cade Van Rapphorst, had a hell of a game this game, as well as Craig Chick. So it is nice that they have those two poles that does, if Baptiste isn't ready to go, and they do have to turn to, you know, maybe Fop to face off, they at least have those two guys that can run at the wings if needed, and give them a much better chance of at least mucking it up. But yeah, definitely concerned a little bit, but nice to see Trevor fight through that injury. You know, you never want players to get injured worse fighting through injury, but clearly, you know, he kept it going, and that was kind of the difference maker in the game for them to win, even if he did start to falter a little bit down the stretch. So I can't wait for a rematch of this game. You know, we have to wait a little bit for a while. That could be the championship game, though, essentially, the way those teams turned out. We'll have to wait until August 6th to see or not even August 6th, I'm sorry. We'll have to wait till the potential playoff matchup between these two teams to see them face again. So disappointing that we'll have to wait a little while, if at all, to see these two teams play again. But certainly round one did not disappoint. And we'll move on now to the second day of the weekend, and we'll talk about Water Dogs. Oh, sorry, we'll talk about Water Dogs Whip Snakes next, but we'll talk about Chaos Cannons. Chaos get their first win. This really felt like a must-win for both teams, but especially the Chaos, who could have gone down 0-5 had they not won this game. So I'll go to you, Brian, with this one. Thoughts on the Chaos? Brian had a tight win, ended up winning 13-11 against the Cannons, had the lead for most of the game. But a lot of it had to do with Blaze Reardon delivering an absolute gem in net. He had 21 saves, I think, in this one. That was his fourth 20-plus save game in the past 3 years, and no other goalie had more than two. So he continues to just be the life for this defense. But thoughts on this Chaos team?
Yeah, we're just going to echo, I think, that if Blaze is going to need to make 20 saves against this Cannons team to win, it's not really indicative of future success. But we're also talking about the Chaos. So I feel like I never want to talk about the Chaos, because then they're going to get to the playoffs in the last spot and then make me really angry for the whole playoffs. So Blaze is still Blaze, but they need to figure out something different if they want to make the playoffs, because if they keep playing this way and the Cannons kind of figure some stuff out, then I think the Chaos are looking like they're going to compete against the Redwoods for the final spot of the playoffs. And who knows what happens there, but from the Cannons' perspective, I think it's a real shame that the Cannons kind of have it figured out at the stripe a little bit, because that was one of their major weaknesses last year. And they kind of don't really have it put together elsewhere. And I think that's a lot of why they're struggling, in particular in transition defense, which was also one of their big weaknesses last year. We saw Morocco bail them out a lot of times this year and last year, but if they let up a lot of transition in games, teams kind of run up the score on them. Against the Chaos, they let up, you know, five goals from defensive players. Rowlett, Jerry Ragonese, best post goal interview I've ever seen in my whole life. That guy's hilarious. But Rowlett, Ragonese, Costabile, and Patrick Resch, Those are just four goals from pretty defensive guys that definitely came in transition, let alone any offensive players that scored off of fast breaks or whatever. So that's something that they still really need to figure out, and I feel like they're just consistently not making adjustments to account for this major weakness of theirs. And if Morocco is not having a 65% save percentage day, I don't see the formula for them to win, particularly against more high-octane teams, dare I say NASCAR offenses like the Atlas or the Chrome. You know what I mean? It's the problems aren't going away, and I feel really bad because Stephen Kelly's really having a good year, and I hope that the Cannons really capitalize off of it because it was one of their bigger pickups in the offseason.
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head, especially with this defense not playing to the level that it needs to. And obviously they've been kind of rotating a bunch of guys in through. We've seen Brody Merrill in and out of the lineup. But like you said, kind of two sides of the same coin with the Chaos Cannons. Cannons are a team, too, that have relied heavily on Nick Morocco, and he's kind of put up Blaze-esque performances. He had a 19-save game earlier this year. And if he's not doing that, they're going to struggle, you know. He's kind of keeping them alive, and I agree with Stephen Kelly. You know, he had another point in this one, 12 for 20 at the stripe. He has done what he needed to do for this team, but they're just not getting consistent offensive production. Despite, adding, I feel like the weird thing about the Cannons is, to me, they look like potentially the worst team in the league at some stretches, but they do seem like they're getting better for the most part. Not necessarily on the defensive end, but they're starting to put it together a little bit, I guess, with the offense. I don't know. They're picking up some guys. They picked up Donville, was a big pickup. Bubba Fairman's playing well for them. Asher Nolting's been looking good. So I think the future is kind of bright for the Cannons. I just don't know if they have enough to kind of hang in these games. It's almost like they have a lot of young players that look promising, but the veteran edge that some of these other teams have, like the Archers, just isn't there for them. You can't really quantify that, but that's kind of a testament to why they've been losing a lot of these close games, with the exception of the Archers game where they got blown out. They've lost a lot of close games where they've even had the lead going into second half or, late games and kind of relinquished that. This was a little bit of a different story, but they had a good shot at beating this Chaos team and kind of let them, just never went out and seized the game like you wanted them to. And Lyles continued to, play as good as he has been, but kind of still missing that edge factor. It's almost like a lot of the offense still is just watching Lyle try to go out there and score. Whereas I want to see them get more involved in the two-man game. And I think it's tough to do that with lack of chemistry. They've had Cherilyn Bitas in and out of the lineup. They've had, obviously, added Donville. Even though Bomberry was, in the lineup a little bit, Shane Jackson was in the lineup. So I feel like Coach Cork is doing a good job of trying to get a bunch of different guys' experience, and that'll pay off long-term. But now we're already at week six. We're at the All-Star break. It's tough to do in this league. That kind of could work in the MLO when you had a little bit more games to kind of get people, some more chemistry. But now you're 1-4. The lineup that they have now, I think, has to be the one that they stick with, because if you keep trying to recycle people in and out, you're just hurting yourself long-term. So, I don't know. Long-winded way of saying that I'm not too high on the Cannons. But I don't know, Topher, did you see any positives from the Cannons? And despite the Chaos winning, do you think they can kind of make a run, or was it kind of just two bad teams duking it out for a win?
Yeah, first, to kind of close the book on the Cannons part of this, I don't know, man. I see it with their offense improving. Ryan Drenner's consistently one of the sneaky, most solid point producers in the league. He never gets much love outside of his tilt and his hair, but his actual production is always really solid, even if he doesn't get much plaudit for it. Charwin Beattie's has been decent on the left side. You mentioned Nolting's good, Lyle's good. So I kind of like the offense figuring out, but like Brian, you said, if this defense, especially in transition, is it's rough, and I don't really know how they can fix it, especially soon. I don't know. Double pull every faceoff just in case. Play Bubba Fairman as an offensive midfielder just to stop transition. That's an idea, maybe. I don't know how they fix it, but they need to fix it. Otherwise, like, they are the clear favorite to miss the playoff, in my opinion.
I agree. I don't know how you fix it, especially just because we're in a league that doesn't really – they don't practice all week. They have one practice before you go into a weekend. Transition defense is you know, 99% communication-based. And how do you prove communication when you're not surrounded by those guys frequently enough to, you know, gain that chemistry? You know, just playing in games, you can get like in a little bit of an offensive groove. But if that communication isn't there on that transition defense, or that decision making isn't drilled into your brain through habitual practice, it's really hard to improve upon. And like Hutton was saying, constantly changing the lineup's only going to hurt any kind of chemistry that you build. So I just thought that was a good point that I wanted to expand upon.
Absolutely. And to try and, you know, get onto the chaos side of things real quick, I think this is the first time that we've seen the chaos be the chaos. Obviously, all the Bandits guys missed the first three, four games of the season. And I think last week was the first time where they all looked like themselves on the field again. You know, Josh Byrne had 4 points. Dane Smith still did his thing. Cloutier was back from a brief little injury. So I think they looked like the chaos, the same team that made the final in Utah, the same team that won the championship last year. They look like that group, even if they still have some rough edges. You know, you mentioned how the defense gave up a lot of shots, which they always seem to do. But they definitely showed, again, the same exact formula and the same bones that led them to success the past few seasons, and which is kind of what we expected, you know, with all those guys missing time for the NLL Finals.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I'm still haven't been completely impressed with the chaos, but that's, I guess, more with their defense. I really think they're missing Johnny Serdak's presence. You know, obviously they had Kennedy on this offseason and Zach Geddes, you know, at short stick defensive midi. But without Johnny Serdak, you know, it's tough for them to play this style of, you know, one-on-one, win your one-on-one matchups, don't slide, let Blaze, you know, do the rest. And they're getting burned a lot on that. So I struggle to see this team going far just because of their issues on defense. But if this offense starts to put up points like we know they can, you know, with all these pieces coming back, Lucia came back, Kyle Jackson's looked great. Crazy to see that we saw Chalen Rogers assist Kyle Jackson against the Cannons when those two players helped the Cannons win the final MLL championship. So I thought that was kind of funny, ironic to see. You would have kind of scratched your head if you heard that 2 years ago. But they have a really good – they have a lot of good pieces all across the board. And when they get Adler back, if he's 100%, I think this Chaos team could be scary to face just because this offense can hang with any other offense, in my opinion. But the defense is still going to be their Achilles heel. And as we mentioned with the Cannons, if you want to win in this league, you have to have a strong defense. And you can't completely rely on your goalie, because if they pitch one bad game, you know, you're done. And lucky for the Chaos last year, Blaze was on point every single game for the most part. I don't think he had a bad game at all last year, and he hasn't really had a bad game this year either. But, you know, all it takes is a one quarter collapse. And, you know, if you're facing a team like the Atlas or the Chrome, that's the difference between winning and losing. So I'm curious to see how this Chaos team does against an Atlas or a Chrome, just because they haven't played those two teams yet. And I think those are going to be true tests of this team, because they look decent against the Archers, but then again, they had a couple of two-pointers that kind of made that game closer than it actually was. So it'll be interesting to see how this fully back now Chaos team does in the second half of the season. But we're running a little bit long, so let's definitely move forward to the last game of the weekend, probably the most exciting one in addition to the Atlas Chrome, and that was the Water Dogs Whip Snakes. I think we were all kind of feeling like it was time for the Water Dogs to step up, and they certainly did in a tight game, but it was definitely close throughout. But, Brian, thoughts on the Water Dogs getting the big win over the Whipsnakes and handing them their first loss of the season?
I don't have a lot of thoughts on this game. I think really it was about time the Whipsnakes kind of tripped over themselves a little. They came out really slow on offense, and that's kind of been my critique of them this whole year so far. You know, it's classic Whipsnakes always winning by one goal or whatever, but like in previous years, it's like the parity of the league was really high. Every game was really close. We haven't seen a lot of blowouts since like really 2019. This year, teams are losing by 6 and 7, and the Whipsnakes are kind of still winning by 1. So if they keep winning, I know they didn't win this week, but if they keep winning by 1, they keep winning by 1. That's great for them. But you can only win so many one goal games in a row. We said that about the Wings all during the NLL season. So I don't know if I'm really like that impressed with this win by the Water Dogs, because when you hold the Whipsnakes scoreless in the first quarter, like, yeah, Ward played phenomenally and their defense is kind of figuring it out. And DeLuca had a good week prior as well. So, like, the defense as a whole unit, not just goalie-wise, is kind of figuring it out. But they didn't, like, really outproduce the Whipsnakes on offense except for the first quarter. So I feel like if the Whipsnakes just kind of went into that game a little bit more awake, they might have taken it away themselves. So I think this was just like a maybe even like a trap game for the Whipsnakes. I don't really have a lot of thoughts. I'm not fully convinced on the Water Dogs yet. I'm still very much on this, like, there are four teams that are, like, really pulling away from the pack, including the Whipsnakes still, and there are four teams that are kind of sitting at the bottom and still trying to figure a lot of stuff out. I just think the Water Dogs kind of squeaked by with one this week.
Yeah, I do agree with you. I think the Water Dogs are still maybe not there yet, but what I saw from this team is I think they can be a contender, given the fact that they put up a good game against Whipsnakes. I haven't completely been super impressed with the Whipsnakes either, but they do have the pieces. And if Tucci can continue to play well at the faceoff stripe and give them a shot, this offense can be one of the best in the league. And you have Kieran McCardle and Michael Sowers, both top 10 in points so far. You know, we'll get to all-star snubs. Kieran McCardle should be an all-star, in my opinion. Maybe not a starter, but definitely a reservist. You know, this defense finally put together, I think, a complete game, both on the short stick defensive mini side. Matt Wichers looked great. I know Joe Keegan's talked at length about how well he's been playing. Higgins is doing well for them. You know, the DiNapoli issue of him being out of the lineup has kind of solved itself with these two young guys playing so well. And, you know, obviously they have three of the top poles in the league in Gobrecht, Ben Randall, and Liam Burns. So nice to see, you know, them kind of put together another complete game against a Whipsnakes offense that does have a lot of firepower. But I think what I was most impressed of about the Water Dogs is their ability to kind of just finish a game out and play four quarters, because I didn't think, even when they kind of, the Whipsnakes went on that run, I didn't think the Water Dogs played poorly at all. I think the Whipsnakes just were able to make some plays. And I think that's what's doomed them the, you know, the first couple weeks of the season, was the Water Dogs didn't put together a complete game. Obviously they had some injuries too, to deal with, but I don't know. I've been impressed, and I think they're a sneaky team. They could be a dark horse. You know, tough to put them ahead of those four other teams we mentioned, but in my opinion, they're right up there with that. I think it's a top five and a bottom three. You know, you could kind of bring the chaos into that conversation when they're all kind of together. But as of right now, I think Redwood's chaos and Cannons are more at the bottom. I don't know. How do you feel, Topher? What did you think of the Water Dogs? Was it a bigger win for the Water Dogs, or was it more of a letdown for the Whipsnakes?
I mean, I think there's definitely a little bit of letdown to the Whipsnakes, especially, as Brian mentioned, that really slow start. Beginning of this game where they kind of didn't play offense for a quarter. But I definitely think, especially if you include the big blowout of the chaos the week before, I think the Water Dogs are kind of figuring out what they are as a team, and, you know, what players go where, and it's just their general lineups and how they want to play. They kind of have things figured out. You know, you mentioned Wichter and Higgins, like, that's their main short sticks now. They're not trying to rotate a bunch of guys. They have their primary guys. They know what they're doing. They know who they're starting. You know, offensively, they know how to play Sowers and McCardle together, and they know, you know, Ethan Walker is the guy out of the box. You know, they know who's going where and how they all flow together. So those pieces are all kind of meshing together finally. And then they have Dylan Ward back, who was really great in this game again. So I think they're finally figuring out who they are, and I think this is just the start of another really strong second half of the season like we saw last year.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, if I'm the Whipsnakes, I'm concerned about, you know, the turnovers. I guess, too, you got to give them a little bit of a pass just because that Williams has been out of the lineup, and now inserting him back in, you know, the offense looks, you know, different than it did in the first 3 weeks, but still haven't been impressed the past 2 weeks with this offense. I mean, they lead the league in turnovers with 94. That's just too many for this offense to sustain. You know, if they, you're able to squeak out these one goal wins, great, but come playoff time, that's going to come back to bite you. And, you know, they've been heavily reliant on Joe Nardella a lot more than probably we've talked about, and Kyle Brunlar. To me, Kyle Brunlar has been their best player so far. And if he hasn't been playing at the elite level that he had in years one and two of the PLL, this team could easily be at 500 or below 500 based on how they've been playing, you know, on offense. So, honestly, I feel like even though I do think, you could put them above the Water Dogs. I think they have more reason to be concerned than the Water Dogs do, in my opinion. You know, might be a hot take there, but I just think the Water Dogs offense has played much better, and I think their defense, although hasn't played great to start the season, is starting to get to form where the Whipsnakes offense hasn't looked any better than it did week one, in my opinion. And adding Zed definitely helps, but they really got to figure it out. I think the fact that they didn't trust James Carlson was kind of a head scratcher because, you know, I highlighted that he had a hat trick in the past three meetings against the Water Dogs, had a sock trick in the last game, you know, earlier this year when they played the Water Dogs. So kind of interesting to see him left out of the lineup against a team that struggles actually to defend on the doorstep. But overall, big win for the Water Dogs. And I'm not too worried if I'm the Whipsnakes, we're 4-1, but I do think they need to take this break to kind of figure out what they want their personnel to be on offense. You know, again, kind of like the Cannons time to experiment is over. You know, you run guarding from the box, are you running from attack? You know, what's the plan? Like, is it back to being Zed and Rambo, and then you get Gutterding maybe on the lefty? You know, I don't know. They got to figure it out, though. You know, maybe you get Brian Cole more involved. But so far, it just still hasn't looked too great from the Whipsnakes. And, you know, offense efficiency-wise, they're one of the worser ones in the league so far. So can't rely on Burnlore again. Kind of back with the Blaze thing. You can't continue to rely on your goalie to kind of bail you out of games. And, you know, he's certainly played well through five games so far, but all it takes is one letdown. But those are our thoughts on week five. We will do a little brief All-Star game preview. Not much to say, you know, it's just a fun game. But did you guys have any snubs, whether it be a guy that, you know, is a reservist and should have been a starter, or a guy that just completely missed the All-Star game altogether? I'll go with you, Brian. Thoughts on the All-Star game rosters. Maybe give everyone what your roster was, or some top picks from your ballot, and who you like, you know, going into this All-Star game.
I can list mine off really quickly. I will preface by saying that I voted after week three, and I didn't recast the ballot to reflect weeks four, and I think voting closed before five. But after week three, this was mine. It was Manny, Teat, Nick Turn, Schreiber, Henningberg, Anderson, Giles Harris, Van Raphorst, Manley, Baptiste, Logan, Costabile, and Concannon. Not a lot that I would change. There are a couple people that I would change after weeks four and five, but not too many. From a snub, I think the two starters of the All-Star game should be Concannon and Burnlore. I think they're just playing better than everyone else on average. I mean, the stat sheet says that too. I know Blaze has, you know, 20 plus save games, but I don't think he's played as high of a level as those two goalies every week so far. So I think that's a starter snub for me. Concannon not being the starter, I think he's earned it, especially coming back from a really brutal injury. So I want to give him a shout out. Other than that, I don't want to steal anybody else's, but my sneaky one that I don't really have that big of a gripe with is, you know, I think Craig Chick is just eternally underrated in this league. And I hope Adam hears me say that. He probably loves how much I'm talking about him this year. But also Scott Radliff. You have Earhart and Costabile, and Costabile got a lot of votes. I even voted for him. I just said that. After week three, he's been playing really good defense. He's been doing a lot of the intangibles really well. He's really stood out in the chaos defense, in my opinion. And then he had that like 5-point game. And he's been great in transition aside from that as well. And at the stripe when they've needed someone to go up there after a violation or something. So he's kind of been like the guy for them. But Craig Chick and also Scott Radliff have been really keeping up with Michael Earhart, who's like the perennial, you know, just automatic every year LSM of the year. Would have loved to see Craig Chick or Scott Radliff get a nod over maybe one of them. I think maybe instead of Earhart for 1 year, just, you know, to mix it up a little bit. And they both deserve it too. So that's why I'm bringing them up.
Yeah, no, I do think, you know, Craig Chick has really flown under the radar for sure. And I don't have too many qualms with it. It's tough to be, you know, too upset about All-Star rosters. You know, it's supposed to be fun, but like I mentioned, Kieran McArdle not being on a roster as, you know, as an All-Star is kind of a head scratcher, just given how much production he's had so far this year. But my roster, I actually, you were able to technically vote still in week five. They closed at midnight of the final day, and because I'm a psycho, I put in my ballot an hour after the final game. So Not much change, though, from week four when I originally kind of did a ballot. The person that I did add to the defensive side was Cade Van Rapphorst after that week five performance. But I had Jeff Teat, Will Manny, Brendan Nickturn. Probably could have maybe put Wisnowskis, but I feel like Nickturn has meant a little bit more to that offense through 5 weeks. Although Wisnowskis, you could easily make a case for him still. Midfield, I had Schreiber, Anderson, and Currier. Zach Currier, again, you know, not maybe showing up as much on the stat sheet, but he does the intangibles. He has more ground balls than some face-off guys. Really thinks he should be deserving of being an all-star. So he's maybe a reservist that I think should be a starter, but not too upset about that because he is an all-star. And then on defense, I had CVR, Graham Hossack, JT Giles-Harris, face-off Trevor Baptiste. I went Danny Logan for short stick defensive midi. I actually went Costabile for LSM. Between him and Earhart was really tight for me, but Costabile, I think, has been able to perform all over the field. Both of them have been scoring, so that was kind of a coin flip, but got to give some love to Costabile there. And then Burnlore was my goalie, but I easily think Jack Kincannon could have been there too, and I agree with you that I think Kincannon deserves to be a starter, despite Blaze, you know, deserving to be an all-star, just given the way the season's gone so far. Those all have been statistically your top two goalies through 5 weeks. So interesting to see Kincannon named a reservist when I think he should be a starter as well. What about you, Topher? What was your all-star roster? Any snubs that you had, whether from the reservist side or altogether?
I don't know. I don't really have any objections with, you know, the way the roster shook out, either starting lineups or otherwise. I think the only guy listed as a snub, like maybe Ashton Olting, you know, he's had a pretty strong rookie year. Maybe you could throw him a shout, but I didn't think, other than McArdle, which you already mentioned, I didn't think I was too aggrieved that anyone left off. Honestly, I might have picked Joe Nardella to be a starting faceoff guy. Splitting hairs doesn't really matter. You know, it's just an all-star game. So I'll just list out my ballot that I filled out here to close out for the sake of completion here. So Nick Turn, Teat, Manny, attack. Pretty fairly unanimous. All of us, I think, had those three guys, or at least most of those three guys. Tom Schreiber. And then I went with Justin Anderson from the Chrome, who's been their lead midfield point scorer. He's been a very valuable asset in providing balance to their offensive unit. And then Matt Moore, who I just love as a 1v1 Dodger. He's been super, kind of a supernova addition without Grant Amen to kind of provide another playmaker. A defense, Mike Manley, JT Giles-Harris, and then Matt Dunn, especially after what he did against Atlas. Also, you can never go wrong with Matt Dunn, even if the stats never back him up. Danny Logan, short stick D midi, CJ Costabile, LSM, same reasons you guys listed out. Trevor Baptiste and Kyle Burnmore, pretty obvious face-off and goalie as well.
Yeah, no, I love the Matt Dunn love, and I agree with you on a lot of that stuff. Matt Moore was one that, had he been listed as a midi, he would have made my midfielder, I think. I don't know. You know, you could play the game who I take off. That's a little bit tougher. Honestly, I'd probably drop Courier for Matt Moore, just given the production through 5 weeks. But he didn't make my roster because he's listed as attack, and I couldn't put him over the three guys I put at attack. But happy to see him named as an all-star. I think it's well-deserving. And looking forward to this all-star game. Going to be some interesting new rules. You know, I don't know if you guys were able to get in on the NFT that they released, but you got to choose two rules that they could potentially do. Some of them, the last kind of, I think, 2 minutes of each quarter, goals are worth 2 points, and 2 point goals are worth 4 points. Another rule proposed change is shortening the arc from 15 yards to 13 yards. I honestly would have liked them to see maybe make the arc kind of less during the high percentage areas. So make it a little bit shorter as you go down towards GLE. That would have been my proposal, but that's not one of the proposals. And then the Elam ending is another one that's interesting, where in the fourth quarter, they'll add whatever the highest scoring team is through three quarters. They'll play to whatever five goals in addition to that score. So if it's a 12-10 game going into the fourth quarter, they'll play to 17. So I think that's an interesting one that I would like to see, just see how it plays out. I don't think I'd ever liked seeing that actually implemented, but it will be interesting to see. And then one I think they've done in the past where goalies actually initiate the next possession after a goal, kind of like the Sixes format, is another one. So we'll see which the two rules are chosen based on the fans for this all-star game, but should be a fun one to watch in Boston on ESPN2, I believe, and the skills competition will be up there as well, actually on ESPN. So we get to watch it on ESPN main channel, so definitely looking forward to that. But Appreciate you guys both hopping on, talking NLL, NPLL, and a little bit of the Professional Box Lacrosse Association as well, even though we don't know much of it. And definitely, if you guys tune in a little bit late, we'll have this up on our podcast format. You can also re-listen to it on Twitter. Definitely subscribe to the podcast if you don't already. And tune in next time to another episode of Pro Lacrosse Talk.